tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after-show entertainment. TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
It's always such an odd transition from the very upbeat AfterBuzz theme to this.
It's my favorite thing. My favorite thing about this show.
So, AfterBuzzers, welcome back to the Fargo Season 2 After Show. Real quick, if you're not doing so already, follow the network everywhere. We're all over social media at AfterBuzz TV. Mm-hmm. I am Lex Michael. I'm all over the social media things as well, at the Lex Michael, and I am here with
Dave Child. I'm at Mr. Dave Child or DaveChild.com.
So, tonight, we are talking about episode 8 of season 2, and it's called Lop Lop. And now, granted, we were only following two storylines this episode. We were keeping track of fewer characters at once than we normally do. But given that, I would still say there is quite a bit to unpack in this episode.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, we've been starting at the top of the show by digging into what the title means and how it relates thematically to the episode. So I don't know if you wanted to kick that off maybe with what you discovered as you were looking around.
Yeah. Well, it's the funnest title to say.
Lop Lop.
Lop Lop is good. And we're back to referencing Dada and surrealist pieces. This time it's a painter.
Yes.
I actually, someone who makes montages and kind of made one of the first graphic novels, which is Max Ernst.
Yes.
And Lop Lop is a character that represents himself. It's kind of his alter ego, kind of wilder alter ego that pops up in a lot of his pieces and a lot of his books and works. Now, what does this mean in the Fargo-verse? Why is it titled this? And I think we can get into it as we talk about the whole episode, but I think this episode really, you saw two characters especially who are dealing with alternate versions of themselves and seeing how other people see them and how they want to be seen themselves.
Yeah, and big moments for the two characters in question. And of course, if you're watching the show, I assume you've seen the episode already. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the two characters that we're talking about specifically are Peggy and Hanzi.
Hanzi.
Who both have their own moments of self-actualization in this episode. And I think I found the same
one
stuff
true
that you did.
And one kind of false. Or actually, maybe even both false, but they're both just dealing, it's rather than self-actualization, which is kind of what Peggy thinks is happening to her.
Sure.
I think they're kind of dealing with who they are truly and who they want to be perceived as.
Sure.
And I think that's what Lop Lop is about. Because Lop Lop was definitely a reference on how the artist perceives himself, and also a wilder kind of, it was like a bird-like character that he put himself as. So
The research I did led me to this idea that Ernst created Lop Lop as a bit of an alter ego for himself as a way to process trauma that he had experienced.
Oh, really? I didn't know about that.
Yeah, no, I don't know, I don't pretend to be an expert on
Lop
Ernst.
Lop experts.
Yeah, I'm not a
We're
Lop
not
Lop historian.
Lop Lop. Perts.
Lopologist.
Yeah, yes. Lopologist.
That's not us. But I did discover that he created this alter ego for himself, this bird, as a way to deal with trauma and to get an additional perspective that was outside of himself, so he could process some of these things that had happened. And I think certainly, you know, whether or not we want to say or we feel that Peggy's quote unquote self actualization is genuine, she does seem to think that it is, and I think it's interesting. The one of the first scenes in the episode, the first time we see Peggy, we're dealing with the aftermath of the attack in the basement from episode 6, and she's got Dodd tied to a chair, but in his place she sees this life coach. And I was doing a bunch of reading on this episode, and one theory is that this guy that she sees, this life coach person, is meant to be a guy by the name of John Hanley Sr., who founded the Real Lifespring Retreat.
Oh, interesting.
And could have been Peggy's own Lop Lop of sorts. in that moment.
Right. Well, I kind of disagree with you there, because I think the therapist wasn't representing her. Maybe it was representing all the things that she wanted to hear at the time, because she was definitely in a conversation with another person, and I don't think she sees herself as a middle-aged man in a very serious suit. Maybe.
But I would say it certainly represents, or I would think it represents, a part of herself that it's a part of her psyche that she wants to be saying these things to. I'm phrasing this very poorly.
Right. She was having a conversation with herself.
Right. Yeah. All of this stuff that she wants to hear. So she's creating completely in her head this external voice, this external speaker that's saying back to her all of the things that she wants to hear.
Yeah. And I think for one of the first times we see kind of the reality of the situation break in when Ed comes back and it's Dodd that says, she's been talking to herself for a very long time. She's seeing people that aren't here, which is a great moment because it kind of is like solidifies Peggy's kind of distance and odd break from reality. And I think it's important what you were saying about Lop Lop earlier to note that both Hanzi and Peggy are dealing with trauma in their past lives.
Yes.
And I think that it's important to note Lop Lop as a version of that trauma and dealing with the trauma, because you could see it out of both of them. Peggy's coming from mostly the what has happened to her, like with the car crash and killing Rye and all of that. But I think also the character also kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in a previous episode, where she's dealing with Vietnam in her own way. There's like that lost scene that we were talking about, I think, in the last episode. There's a deleted scene where she sees her fiancé go away.
That's right, yeah.
Which is not like, it's not canon because not in the actual show, but I think it kind of nods towards maybe a trauma that she's dealt with as part of that Vietnam as a whole, which Hanzi's still dealing with. He's kind of pulling a Rambo first blood throughout this entire episode.
Yep.
In a lot of ways. Okay. So I guess what after that, they put him in the trunk.
They drive away. They take Dodd's car smartly. Now, the decisions that the Blomquists are making, while completely understandable, are not terribly consistent as far as their foresight and their practicality. Because while they have the foresight to go, well, they'll be looking for our car, we should take Dodd's car so that we're less conspicuous in this other vehicle, they don't have the foresight to, say, take the note off of the fridge, which Hanzi finds later, which leads him directly to... Oh, her name is escaping me at this moment.
The lady from the beauty parlor.
By the time we get back around to that point in the story, I'll remember what it is.
Okay, sure.
But yeah, so they take and they decide that they're going to go hide out at the cabin of Uncle Grady, and we know nothing about Uncle Grady other than apparently he smells like athlete's foot.
Oh, I thought he maybe got athlete's foot, so they wanted to like not go to the place where he got athlete's foot.
Oh no, they specifically reference Ed says that. Peggy said at one point that he smells like athlete's foot.
Oh, right. Okay. I thought I misheard it then. I thought he said, like, he got athlete's foot. That's why we never went into the cabin. I'm like, wow, that's a... For someone who has, like, a basement full of magazines and kind of a hoarder complex, that was kind of an odd thing to be like, oh, that's a bit too icky for me. So.
And there's that wonderful shot, and it shows you just how close it was. They leave and almost immediately, Lou and Hank arrive at the house.
Right.
And
I mean, Lou and Hank, this is not their brightest moment. I do have to say, like, Hank is kicking himself. At least they really, because we talked about how much of a character change that was for him to just leave. And at least you see him go like, all right, I need to go to the hospital, kind of enforcing the idea that really was a big hit.
And I love how embarrassed he is about it as well. And he says, like, don't tell Betsy. And Lou's like, well, I'm more scared of her than I am of you. I'm calling her. Yeah.
But Lou even, like, I mean, he really should have run after Ed.
Probably.
He should have, rather than getting in the car, because apparently Ed knew a faster way to get to the house.
Well, I was going
to
say, there are certain leaps that you have to take in this episode, and there aren't many. I think it's incredible how tightly structured the writing this season has been, but there are a couple of leaps I think this episode asks you to make, one of which is Ed was somehow able to make it back far enough ahead of the two of them in their cruiser on foot.
Yeah.
To get Peggy, have this conversation, and leave.
Yeah, and also Ed is kind of not a sleek fellow, so no. He can run rather fast for someone who's, you know, a hefty fella.
Yeah, they actually, you know, I hadn't thought too much about it, because when I see him, you know, you see Jesse Plemons, and I'm familiar with Jesse Plemons first and foremost.
Yes.
It was Breaking Bad, which first brought him to my attention.
Friday Night Lights is what I'm
for a lot of
of
people.
Where he's like a football player size, and he's actually pretty in good shape. He's not in such good shape anymore.
I almost forget that he's carrying around this large midsection on the show until in this episode you get Hanzi using the fact that he's overweight as a descriptor.
Yeah at the same episode where you see him bolt really fast.
Yeah,
and also I like how you say carrying around, like he could just take it off. Take it off when he gets back to the cabin.
I think when Jesse Plemons goes back to his trailer, he could probably take it off.
Probably, yeah. When he's working on the next role, I think he could probably take it off.
And then almost immediately, Hanzi arrives at the house as well, and he's searching around, and he finds that Constance, by the way, is her name.
Constance!
Got it. Ka-ching. Finds the note, which leads him directly to her.
Right, yeah. And you see her preparing this really romantic dinner. By the way, I want to nod of respect to the art department on who's decided to make the art in the Constance's bedroom or hotel room that she was planning on sharing with Peggy and having a romantic night. Two flowers, kind of facing one another. I'm like, okay, I see what you're doing there with that image. That two budding flowers. facing one another right in between the two beds. I'm like, okay. All right.
It's
way to be subtle, guys.
It's both the least subtle and most subtle, I think, production design touch.
And there were, like, black outlines on a white wall. So it wasn't even... At first, I was like, is that just hanging on the wall? Oh, okay, they're flowers. They're not female genitals. Like, I thought they were. Okay, all right.
So I feel like we're gonna jump around a little bit, but since there isn't too terribly much to talk about
as relates to
Constance in this episode, Hanzi arrives at the hotel room and there's this very tense phone conversation where clearly he's pushing Constance to try and get Peggy to tell her where she is so that Hanzi can go find them.
Right,
and it doesn't pan out.
No, but it gets rather close though. It's enough.
Yeah.
It's enough. Are you talking about when he's got his arm around her and
is
kind of squeezing the information out of Peggy? It's enough to really know to go to a store. It's enough to drive around an area and find maybe a central location to kind of narrow the search down. And
right.
He knows that there's a cabin in the woods somewhere.
You're right. And obviously we know that ultimately by the end of the episode he does locate them. But my question really is, do you think Hanzi left without killing her?
That's a good question.
Because we don't see it. And ordinarily, again, and we've made comments about this in the past, I feel like TV has conditioned us now to go, well, if we don't see a body, then they may not really be dead. But we've seen now enough times this season, deaths happen off screen. We didn't see Joe Bullo die. We saw his hand.
Right.
We didn't see Otto die. I believe Simone to be dead at this point.
Well, the thing is, like, yeah, I think Simone's dead. Well, we still have two episodes, and this ends...
They all come back.
This ends in a surprising spot. I mean, this episode is a climax that I expected to see at least in the next episode, if not the very last episode. It was a very odd climax in this one. But anyways, we'll get to that. With Constance, I don't think it matters too much.
Ultimately doesn't.
I think her story has come to an end either way. I think that her involvement in the Blomqvist lives has kind of ended. But I think that judging from his kind of attitude in this episode and the journey that he's going through, I imagine he left her alive because I don't think she was any threat at all, maybe to call the cops. So that might have actually doomed her a little bit, but I don't know. I wasn't very sure. I actually expected to see her actually die or not die. Because she didn't die, I expect that she's still alive.
Yeah, and I agree with you completely. I think at this point, regardless of whether or not there's another body to add to the count, I think her utility to the story is more or less.
I think we're going to get some sort of, and there's another body, oh, here she is, like, you know,
right
over the cop car visiting maybe Peggy in jail which could possibly happen.
Sure.
But, you know, it's... Is he at the... Has he passed the redneck bar yet? When we're... As we're talking about this? Did we skip over that?
Well, we were going to jump around regardless. But okay. I believe that that is... I believe that's... Actually, we may have jumped past it, but we're going to jump
right.
back to
well,
it.
Well, at some point, he believes that he's looking for... he's looking in a town of Sioux Falls to find the couple, and he finds this bar that for one thing, the first thing he sees is a plaque dedicating the death of like 22
Indians 22 were hanged here.
Sioux Indians hanged there, and right underneath it, vomit. It's just a pile of vomit. And he enters this bar, which turns out to be the most racist bar in the world.
Yeah.
And he sits down. By the way, behind the bartender, on the wall, are symbols that look a lot like the alien symbols.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I missed that.
Yeah, it's they're right up on the bar. Now, there's some theories about this. Some people think that they're actual Sioux or Native American symbols, that's how they're kind of connected
okay.
to the alien signs. I came up with another theory on Reddit, on the Fargo Reddit forum, which thank you guys for that. But it had cow brands. That for farmers and like cowboys, like who branded cattle.
Interesting.
So that could be another aspect of it, or it could be a little bit of both, a little bit of A, a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. So it's, they were just there, and I wanted to pay note at that. But anyways,
it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think historical context has been significant as relates to the story of the season or specifically uh-huh. how certain characters interact with each other. This might be the most time we've spent with Hanzi concentrated at any point up till now.
And Except for maybe when he was going through the Waffle House.
A good point.
But that was a silent kind of moment.
But you also see so much more, and obviously it plays into every decision that he makes, all the violent actions that he takes or occasionally doesn't take in this episode. But I think it's important to point out we're in 1979, and this was, if I'm not mistaken, it was only 6 years after Wounded Knee. Mm-hmm. It was only 6 years after, like, the American Indian Movement really began.
Right.
So you have, you know, you cannot discount, and you see some of it in the episode with how some of these people at the bar talk to and treat Hanzi, you see yeah. this horrible, racist, inhuman treatment of him because he's a Native American. And he points out, you know, I forget, he's got a Purple Heart, he's
yeah,
got a Bronze
well they,
Star,
they
three
treat
tours
him,
in Vietnam.
They treat him like he's from another country. They treat him like he's not an American citizen, which is really ironic because the Native Americans were maybe the first, like, American citizens.
They were literally here before
yeah,
anyone else.
They were. And, and he kind of puts it in their face that he's a war hero. He's someone who's fought their battles. He's fought America's battles, and he's come back from them. And when he asks for water, he gets spit in it.
Yep.
And people don't even realize that he's someone who's not, you know, he's not a refugee. He's not like a guy from another country. He's not someone who's a freeloader. He's an American citizen who's fought the same battles as them. And when he leaves, that doesn't really help that nice little retort that he has, because he gets a bunch of rednecks like right behind him.
Well, they follow him out, and there's they continue to throw slurs at him. And I think there's a moment, and you don't see it. It's actually great. Zahn McLaren, who, again, you can't tip your hat enough to him, the actor who plays Hanzi.
Yeah,
you don't see his face. It's just you watch his pace as he's walking back to the truck.
He also has that moment where he just says, like, I just wanted a glass of water.
Yeah.
Which says so much, because he didn't want – he's a dangerous man. He is as powerful and dangerous as Malvo is, but he's not as much of a force of destruction. He's more of like he's a gun that you aim at people.
Yes.
But he's not like – he's not an atomic bomb.
Right.
He doesn't want to just, like, destroy everyone. So when he realizes he has to go on the attack, he has to go on the offensive, this is the first time you see a sense of emotion in his eyes, because he's able to really carry this cold look throughout all these episodes.
Yeah.
Where you don't really know what's playing behind the eyes. You don't know if he's someone who's loyal to Dodd or loyal to the rest of the family, is off on his own agenda, or if he's someone with an actual, like, you know, sense of heart or anything. You don't really know. There's a lot of stoneness behind him.
Right.
And at that moment, you just see it kind of melt away, and you knew what was coming. He was going to be Rambo First Blood.
Well, it's like, yeah, exactly. When he is walking away from these rednecks who are throwing these insults at him, these very specific racial slurs, yeah. And you see the back of his head, and then you see him stop, and you see him turn, and there's a moment where, and again, it's perfect for that character because, like you say, he is so stone-faced and stoic and not so quick to show emotion. You don't see really the moment where the camel's back breaks.
Yeah.
You just know that he stops, he turns, pulls his gun, and then just kneecaps two of them.
All of them. And then the cops pull up almost immediately. Oh, because he goes back into the bar,
shoots the bartender.
It's almost like you almost think it's deserved at this point because there's a part of you that, like, is it Schadenfreude? Where it just has that feeling of just like, oh yeah, they deserve it though. You kind of want him to go off on this killing spree. And when he does, you're just like, oh well, you know, they deserve it. And even like the everyone he kills or everyone he shoots is basically says a racist slur to them. Because
even the troopers come out and they say freeze, I'm quoting, freeze Cochise.
Yeah, and then so he just kills them.
The two troopers that he kills.
The two troopers. And it's the two troopers that we heard in the previous episode that were killed. And a lot of the stuff that happened in this episode was hinted at the previous one. We're just seeing the other half of the day. We're seeing the other perspective of that time. So then he gets back in the car and he goes back to and he finds the store, the gas station where the guy is, and basically has a scene straight out of the movie.
The lake, the down at the lake, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says, well, he's going crazy there down at the lake. He's going crazy there down at the lake. Like saying that over and over and over again. That was straight out of the movie. It happens when one of the officers pulls up to a guy who's like shoveling his driveway. I just rewatched the scene just because I was like, that was definitely in the movie, and so I had to kind of catch up on that. But yeah, so he finds the location of the Blomquist, and now let's, I guess, backtrack.
Yeah, we'll backtrack, and then we'll get to where they convene. Right. So I thought all season so far they've used split screen to a phenomenal effect to show us, right, build tension, showing us things that are happening concurrently in separate locations, or at the very least, certainly not right next to each other. And the way they play the scene between the Blomquist in the car, and they use the split screen to show so clearly how disconnected the two of them are from each other as they're right next to each other having, on the surface, I guess, the same conversation. You see you see how clearly they're not actually having the same conversation.
Yeah, which was kind of a surprise because in the previous episodes, it seemed like they were starting to come together on stuff. It seemed like it was kind of a love story that was like, okay, they kind of are in the same location, they're in the same thing, but everything that happened in that basement with Dodd kind of broke Peggy.
Well, and I think that's something that you see several examples of in this episode. Mm-hmm. Peggy has, I guess maybe the colloquial way to put it, has just completely lost it.
Right, yeah.
And she's talking like...
It's a technical term, I believe.
She's completely lost it. She's gone full lop-lopsidaisical.
Yeah, she's in full lop-lop.
But so she's talking as if this is the greatest thing that's ever happened.
Right.
Like, they've broken free of this rut, and Ed doesn't really know what she's talking
Ed's
about.
Ed's still
like, that
trying
was
to survive,
home.
And he doesn't quite know what to make out of Peggy's, like, positive attitude at this, because I think at first he was a little worried, and then he's just kind of like, okay, as long as you stay positive, and he kind of laughs at it, but they're just in totally separate worlds, and they don't quite know what's going
Ed
on.
And Ed is... It almost sounds like Ed is talking to himself because he's keeping his eyes completely straight right on the road, and he's talking about logistics. And he's almost not mumbling exactly, but he's saying it almost under his breath to the point where I wondered, is he even really focused on relaying this information to Peggy, or is he saying it because he's just running through thoughts and he doesn't know what else to do in that
moment?
He
also doesn't really know how to get out of the police situation. He knows how to maybe save – he has an idea about how to save his skin with the with the Gerhardts, which is just to kidnap Dodd and to kind of give Dodd back to them and hope, like, is this enough? Is this going to be enough? And then hopefully it'll save his skin.
Well, and that's the plan initially. And we see the Gerhardt side of the equation in the previous episode where they're receiving these calls and not answering them. But Ed's plan, as described by Ed to Peggy, is essentially, well, if we give him back, maybe they'll leave us alone, which... please feel free to disagree. It's a bad plan.
Oh.
That's an exceptionally, almost unthinkably bad plan.
It doesn't make any sense. Really, their safest option, if they were thinking of it, is just to turn themselves into the police.
Right.
And just to keep the police protecting them. But, you know, they're not in a logical state of mind.
Nope.
So they're just like, okay, we got to get free. Because right now they have their freedom and they need their safety. And
right.
So they think the safety is to get Dodd in the trunk and get him to the cabin. So in the cabin, we see a few mirrored images from the movie.
It almost like an inverse of many elements of the movie.
Right, yeah. Because you even get Dodd in tied up almost in the exact same position as the wife in that. And there's even a wood chipper in the back, by the way.
Yeah.
There's a nice shot of the wood chipper just to be like, paying attention.
Worth noting, before they even get Dodd inside, he tries to escape and they have to zap him multiple times with the prod to the point where he almost bites his tongue out of his own mouth.
Right, yes, yes. A lot of zapping.
A lot of zapping
being done, which is good to see, because Dodd's kind of a dick.
Let's be honest, nothing happens to Dodd that he does not deserve entirely.
That's very true, yeah. Except maybe the peeing in the cup. I think he could have just wet himself. Because I felt bad for... it looked like a teapot.
Yeah.
And so now they have this teapot that, like, we can never make tea out of that teapot. It's the Dodd urine teapot. It's not the... It's they'll have to go without tea now.
I will say... If you had asked me in first 3-4 episodes, I never in 1,000 years would have thought that we'd be now 2 episodes from the end of the season and one character would have said to another that they better not pee on them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I foresaw it, but I thought it was 2 other characters. I thought it was going to be Hansi and Hank.
Peeing on each other?
Peeing on each
other. As they get lifted into space?
Yeah,
as they get lifted into space.
Don't pee on me. One thing before we hit these aliens, you better not pee on me. Oh, boy.
Wow.
I knew Ed was going to get his hands on someone's junk. I just thought it was going to be a bit different.
Sure.
Yeah, than that. That was predictable.
Did you know or did you hope?
I hoped.
Sure.
I really hoped. This is in my Fargo slash fishing fiction that you can look up. Fargo and Never Come Back Again.
So
that's the name of my slash fiction that I haven't written yet, but it's going to be.
So, okay, yeah. The one act of kindness, I suppose. Well, no, there are moments, and that's the thing. Mm-hmm. There are moments, especially once Ed goes to make these phone calls and leaves Dodd alone with Peggy.
Yeah, and this is interesting because these are two characters that kind of represent the exact different sides of a battle that's being fought in the 70s at this point, is to figure out, you know, this is the kind of the start of the feminist self-actualization movement. So you have Peggy, who's trying to self-actualize and become the best woman and wife that she can be without necessarily breaking the constraints of what she thinks marriage is in the past. And then you have Dodd, who's just a raging misogynist.
Yep.
And just hates women entirely. So even while tied up, he's like, I'm going to show you the back of my hand. I'm going to teach you a lesson.
For a second, he tries a different tact where he tries to appeal to Peggy's humanity by saying, you know, I've got 4 daughters. I'm not such a bad guy. But he can't. He can't even keep that up for more than a thousand.
He also just called her a whore. So he's like, you're a whore. I got 4 daughters. Look at me.
And then,
this is also a lie, I think.
And then Peggy stabs him in the shoulder.
Yeah, this was an amazing scene because it showed a side of Peggy that we've kind of hinted around, but now we see it full force where you see she doesn't necessarily hurt him entirely, but hurts him.
Oh, no, it's like, definitely, mind your manners.
Yeah, definitely, like, stabs him and has this nice little... It has this thing that we keep talking about where the most important thing in the Fargo-verse is that you're decent.
Yes.
Is that you're a decent person who's polite. So having this knife and forcing someone to be polite is kind of an aspect of that weird separation of reality and what they think is proper.
Right.
And she represents that to a T. And it also has this weird moment where she stabs him and doesn't feel like she realizes what she's done or how far she's gone.
She seems again, eerily disconnected from what she's doing
and
in
almost
the moment.
Delighted by it.
Yes,
almost like this is part of her self-actualization that she found. This is part of her lop lop. That she's able to lop lop is actually the sound the knife made when going into Dodd's chest. Lop lop, just two little lops.
Well, and again, she stabs him once. He insults her, stabs him in the other shoulder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then sits there and feeds him beans.
The beans were the scariest part because she not only said like, "Hey, do you want beans?" He said no. So this was this forced kindness. That she was just talking and then sat down to force the beans. And then the only time she kind of felt remorse is when she realized, oh, she fed him beans.
Yeah,
and
he didn't, want, beans. And Dodd, I think at that point, Dodd is petrified a little bit. And he's just like, no, it's fine. It's totally okay. But she's talking about, and again, it's what she's been talking about this entire episode. She's talking about how important it is to stay positive and how, you know, she's upset that Ed's been a little stressed out, but we're all going to get there. She said the line, you know, positive Peggy, that's what they call me. And again, it's like, this is, okay, so I think Peggy's gone for all intents and purposes. Like, this version of Peggy's there. But the Peggy that, as Hank would put it, the Peggy that isn't a little bit touched is, I think, doesn't exist anymore.
No.
And this version
I don't know if she ever existed.
No,
I think that Peggy was always a little touched. She was always...
As generous as I can be.
She was being touched all throughout this, I think.
And there's that's your slash fiction again.
Yeah, again. Sorry.
But this scene where it really seems like she's got it in her head that as long as we keep our chins up and we do what we got to do, we be the best versions of ourselves, that somehow their lives will go back to normal.
Yeah. And also, at this time, she's struggling with a TV that doesn't work a lot, like in the Fargo movie.
Yes.
And also, like, in the Fargo movie, there's, like, dung beetles or there's the scarabs or something that we see briefly. That also happens in the movie. And also, in the movie version of it, Peter Stormare ends up watching a soap opera with Bruce Campbell in it.
Yes.
And instead of watching Bruce Campbell, she actually watches a movie starring a young Ronald Reagan.
So this movie that she's watching, and I didn't realize this immediately as I was watching the episode, but as I was doing a little bit of reading after the fact, this is a movie, it's a fictional movie, but it's a fictional movie called Operation Eagle's Nest, which apparently Molly was also watching in episode 3, and Reagan himself, Bruce Campbell, referenced in episode 5.
Right.
So this movie has been a lingering thread as well, and I thought there were some really, really great touches in how they chose to use the movie and where they placed it. I thought, for example, the fact that also something that we skipped over that keeps coming up again and again is Peggy's lop-lop therapist earlier in the episode asked her that question about, do you understand the difference between thinking and being?
Being, of course.
She says, you know, well, I'm not going to think about the person I want to be. I'm just going to be that person. And so she's, I think, over the course of the episode, more and more committed to, yeah, we're going to be the positivity thing and then being in the moment, being the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful technique where you see the, you know, the black and white TV interference gradually fades away as Peggy, not thinking, just being totally present in the moment, gets more and more sucked into this
immersed
movie that she's watching. And that's when Dodd is able to get himself untied.
Right. And also during the movie, and I should have rewound and watched this again, but did the woman – this was maybe in my mind, but did the woman in the movie have that Fargo accent?
I couldn't – without going back and checking.
I feel like there was a moment where she slipped into the accent, which means I think that we were seeing it through Peggy's mind and that she saw herself as that woman and she saw herself as the two women trapped in the basement and there's a Nazi coming, but they're saved by a white knight – who's played by young Ronald Reagan. And it's that imagery that keeps popping up through the season of the 70s wanting a hero to come and save the day. And in the 80s, it's Ronald Reagan leading that idealized America where everything's like, you know, perfect, city on the hill, and he's the hero to save the day.
Yep.
But what happens in the movie...
Yep.
What happens in real life or, you know, in the cabin... is the Nazi is shot, and then you see the Nazi stand up.
Get back up.
And go after them again.
Yep.
And at that moment, we see that Dodd has left his bounds and is now, you know, behind her at that moment and kind of takes control of the situation.
Well, and I think we've talked a bunch about exactly what you're saying about Reagan being this idealized hero that everyone expects to come in and save the day. But even in the movie where the Reagan character apparently saves the day, he doesn't. Just in the same way that we've talked about, it's this hero that never actually comes.
He never can actually save the day. He can never actually make that city the city on the hill.
Exactly. And then there are some interesting parallels. And, you know, if you read recaps of this episode, you saw a bunch of different people dissecting it a bunch of different ways. The couple, before they're saved by the Reagan character, are talking about essentially one having to sacrifice themselves for the other because there's no way both of them are going to make this out of the situation.
Make it out of the situation.
So that, you know, a lot of people are theorizing, is there a direct parallel here to the Blomquist?
Interesting.
Is one of them going to have to give up everything, whether it's their freedom or their lives, so that the other one can make it out of the situation at all?
Right. It would be more if we could talk about that in predictions. Let's save that for predictions.
Sure.
Because we also have to talk about Ed. What's Ed has been dealing with the situation has been calling the Gerhardts and not getting response. By the way, this is how he knows
this
where
is what
Mike
was,
Milligan.
One of the moments in the episode where I'm like, okay, well, I'll take the leap. I love this show. I'll take that leap with you, sure.
I'll go with it, I guess, because I was like, how did he get that number? Oh, he saw that he was staying there in a newspaper. The newspaper's headline.
So this raises a number of questions to me. First and foremost is Mike Milligan so far has been portrayed as somebody who, whatever else he is exceptional at this very dark, seedy job that he has to do. It seems highly unlikely to me that he's going to put himself in a situation where his name and location are published in a newspaper.
Well, he's also someone who, like the Gerhardts, are kind of immune from the law and immune from they're in a whole nother plane of existence when it comes to justice, because they seem to interact with the law without getting arrested all the time.
Sure.
So it's actually in this world that they're building up, it makes sense that maybe he's a notorious criminal and just hasn't been arrested for it yet. He's kind of a he's kind of a Scarface type character that you kind of know, everyone knows he's there.
Right.
But Al Capone, I mean, like, he's kind of like someone who could be, everyone knows is a gangster but hasn't been arrested for it yet. They haven't found the tax fraud.
Okay.
Maybe, but it's still a stretch.
In a world where we haven't established that, I could buy that. I could make that leap, but it's still, there's a moment of, yeah.
It's funny because this show has so much intelligent writing that when there is like a moment that's just kind of like, and Hank gets hit on the head, and Mike Milligan is deceased in a newspaper, I was like, okay, I'll go with it. Because everything else is genius, but I'll go with this.
Sure.
Anyways.
But it's not like it breaks the episode. I'm not going to speak for you, but in my perception, it's not bad, per se.
No.
It just feels a little bit out of step with...
When you look at it through a microscope like we're doing, it seems a little like the weakest link. But when you don't... When you're just enjoying the show, it doesn't really matter.
I forgot... Until this episode ended, and I went, how many are left? There's two left. So I think there's a certain amount of decision-making you have to do as a team of writers to go, well, we only have so much more time to tell this story. We have to get here. What are some ways that don't completely break the logic of this world that we can make things happen a little bit more quickly?
Yeah. I think that's true. I think they could have solved it if they had just... Mike passing, I don't know. That's a harder one.
Well,
to
look,
choose.
if it was me, I would almost what I thought might happen because right. we know that the Gerhardts didn't answer the phone. We know that Bear was behaving in a way that made it seem like he'd just as soon have Dodd dead. The first thought that I had, I didn't have it after last week's show, or I would have thrown it out in predictions. But as I was thinking about it over the course of the week, I went, well, we know somebody. Somehow Ed gets Milligan's number. Wouldn't it be interesting if Bear or someone over there gave up Dodd willingly?
Right, that's true.
But you know what? I'm certainly not saying I'm disappointed that didn't happen. I guarantee whatever's going to happen in the next two episodes is far smarter than anything that I would come up with.
Right.
But that was my first thought. So when it was newspaper, I went, oh, okay.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I would have had like one interaction with Mike and him, and just passed off a card.
Sure.
But that was that. That's even harder to think of. And I would have had Hank just stayed unconscious. I don't know why they didn't do that. I don't know why Hank got up in the first place. I think he just should have stayed down there. They could have done the running thing. They could have done all of that. Just Hank's unconscious. But that, anyways, that's dwelling on things. One thing that's important that's happening with Ed as he's making these phone calls is he's making these phone calls in front of a unfinished Hangman game.
Yeah, that says Sioux Falls.
Yeah, but it is also interesting foreshadowing to what happens to him later in the episode.
Yes.
Because he's constantly – and I think I misspoke earlier. It's Ed that keeps going into the gas station and saying he's going crazy down by the cabin, by the lake. And that's what really – that's the thing that kind of – the biggest lead that leads everyone to the cabin, much like in the movie with Steve Buscemi saying he's going crazy down by the lake.
Yes.
So that's the connection there. So, and also there is this confusion with the gas station guy and the bartender from the movie where they both, everyone thinks that they're talking about women when he says redhead.
Yeah.
And there's
yeah.
like this moment in the movie, Steve Buscemi's really asking for women, like, to find a prostitute to bring down by the cabin. And this guy just assumes Hansi wants a prostitute when he shows up and talks to him. But notice also how Hansi didn't kill the gas station guy.
No.
Which is actually makes me think that Constance is still alive.
I think because it would be consistent because the only people that you see, and again, we'll put an even finer point on it very, very shortly. The only people that receive Hansi's wrath in this episode are people that he feels have insulted him personally.
Right. So at this moment, Ed started the gears turning on the Kansas City folk. Heading towards Sioux Falls.
So what I think is interesting, too, about this conversation that he has with Mike Milligan, and of course Mike Milligan gets, even in his brief appearance in this episode, gets some wonderful moments.
Yeah, gets the best lines out of like the 1 minute or 2 minutes he's actually in the episode.
Yeah, and the actor's name is Bokeem Woodbine, and I know I've seen him in something else. Somebody on Twitter, on the internet, please, like, throw me his filmography, because I can't look it up myself, I guess.
We don't look at IMDb.
We use the internet very selectively. But he's phenomenal. He was in, what, tops 2 minutes of this episode?
Yeah.
And has some of the most wonderful, like, he straight up, when Ed says, I've got Dodd in the trunk of my car, do you want him? Straight up says, is it inappropriate if I kiss you when we meet?
Yeah.
And then even just his, you know, his Ed hears Mike Milligan's tone maybe and asks him, you know, what? And Milligan's like, no, it's been a day. And, you know, you cut back to Mike Milligan and it's, of course, immediately after he and the Kitchen Brother had to kill the Undertaker and his dudes.
Yeah.
They're covered in blood. There's blood everywhere. And Milligan's just like, yeah, it's been a day.
But yeah, that really also reinforces how fish out of water Mike is in this Fargo verse. How he kind of like the way he talks and the way he interacts with people and the way he can be so forward with I'm going to kiss you on the mouth joke is not at all Midwestern. It just kind of doesn't click with Ed. That's like, wait, what?
And the other thing that I thought was really interesting about the phone conversation in an episode where this idea of self-actualization, this idea of lop-lopping, if you will, is such a prominent thematic point. Ed certainly doesn't have the same moment of, for lack of a better term, let's just call it actualization that Peggy or Hansi has, but I do think it's interesting that he refers to himself as the Butcher of Laverne for the first time in this phone conversation. Because he's not Mike Milligan, he's not Hansi, but he did kill a couple of people.
Yeah.
And I feel like you don't kill a couple
That's
of
true.
People and not change, like, very much in your core.
That we found a third lop-lop.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that.
So
this was his lop-lop moment because he was able to come out as the Butcher alter ego.
And I think certainly there's a certain amount of that was him posturing because he knows he's talking to a criminal.
Right, yeah.
But at the same time, to hear him say it, his willingness to do that felt a little bit like him coming to terms with this is part of who I am now.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. That's great. So he goes back.
Yeah, that's great. What?
No, I agree with everything you just said. I just was like, yeah, I can't add any more to that perfect version of that. So he goes back to the cabin, That's when he discovers there's a trap set for him.
Yeah, Peggy's been knocked out. At first, he doesn't know if she's dead or alive.
Yeah, and runs to her and then gets hung or hanged. I think it's actually hanged.
I believe it's hanged.
Yeah, in this...
Hung means something else entirely.
Yeah. Save that for the slash fiction.
Well, that's where that joke in Blazing Saddles comes from. Where, like, they said you was hung. They was right. Yeah. Ha, ha, ha. Anyway.
Perfect.
Hanged.
What's important here from Dodd's perspective, and I think his ultimate downfall, which I was really happy to see, is how much he set a trap for the guy. And how much he just didn't think the woman was a problem.
Yep.
Just didn't thought of Peggy as like not, he's not going to get in the way of everything. He starts going on this men's rights misogynist like speech out of nowhere, just talking about how like women are taking men down, Samson, Delilah, blah, blah, blah. And as that's happening and as Ed is being hanged, and I thought that was the end of Ed for a second there.
Well, I think...
Because he stopped moving.
I think if Peggy had been a second slower, he'd be gone.
Yeah, and then she reacts and is really his ultimate downfall because it kind of cripples him, gets him in the feet, and then cuts down Ed, and then Hanzi comes in.
And this, of course, Dodd, being the absolute dolt that he is, assumes, okay, great, I'm great, I'm being rescued. Kill him. We're done. We kill him now.
He doesn't have any sort of gratitude. He takes any sort of loyalty for granted. He feels like he's entitled to have a loyal servant, and he's entitled to win the day at the end. And instead, what happens is some of the first words he says to Hanzi is mongrel and half breed.
Yep.
And Hanzi's had quite a day.
It's been quite a day for Hanzi.
And it's a breaking point for him. And he just shoots Dodd right in the head, which is the most surprising moment of the series.
My jaw dropped, and then I just started laughing.
I just went like, yes, thank you. Thank you. I was so ready for someone to shoot. Dodd has been a wonderful asshole to watch, which is a terrible sentence to say. But it's
slash fiction.
Yeah, but he's great to watch, but I needed him dead.
It is almost, there's a little bit of me that's sad that we won't get two more episodes of Jeffrey Donovan's performance, because this episode, I think more than any other episode, you saw so many, ultimately, yes, you come back to the same Dodd, this is an awful, awful, wretched person. Yeah. But you see Dodd get to be very comedic.
Weak and defenseless.
And then, of course, circles right back around to this person, this version of himself that he just can't help but be. And right. He finally, yes, he gets the bullet in the head that I think we've all been hoping somebody would.
Yeah. And then Hanzi wants a haircut.
So this was an interesting touch, mm-hmm. I thought. And this, I think, was Hanzi's moment of finally. It's the combination of putting a bullet in Dodd's head and breaking free completely of that life and that world. These people who he must have known as long, and you know, you don't know exactly how long he's been involved with the Gerhardts. That's a bit ambiguous, but he must have known these people aren't his friends,
right?
And this is finally, obviously, is a very, very direct and extreme way of severing that connection completely.
Yeah,
but then turns to Peggy, and I think the Blomquists probably assume for a minute that they're next, mm-hmm. asks Peggy to cut his hair, says that he wants a more professional haircut, shorter on the sides and in the back. And I think it's interesting in I'm trying to see what's yeah. So in certain Native American cultures, cutting of the male hair is a symbol of mourning.
Yeah, it's a symbol of mourning, and it's also I think it's also a symbol of defeat in a lot of ways. Am I wrong there? Because it's kind of and it's also just, you could see it as severing himself from a Native American past in a way. I think it's to kind of deal with the racism he's just like found. And also, you got to realize he just killed someone who just referenced Samson a ton, so that's also a big part of it too, that he wanted, I think it's also a sense of strength that he wanted to just get drained out of him. It's that warrior aspect that I think he just wanted out of his system. So that's why he really asked for the haircut at that moment. It's also just a wonderful moment because you see in Peggy's eyes that there's a chance, and Ed's eyes, that there's a chance that Peggy could stab him at that. And I really didn't want that to happen.
My assumption, and it's an incredibly tense bit of business when he sits down and Peggy prepares to start cutting the hair, yeah, because you
know, great editing, great acting at that moment.
You know that you've got the dead dot on the floor and you've got Hansi in the chair, Peggy's behind him with the scissors, and Ed is positioned, it looks like, directly in front of Hansi.
Yeah.
You don't see where Hansi's gun is or where it's pointed, but it doesn't look like he puts it away. So right. My fear was that Peggy would try and stab him and would get Ed Shut. Killed.
I thought, yeah, Ed was going to get killed, or Peggy was going to get killed, or both of them were going to be killed. Because you can't stab a guy and totally incapacitate him. You right. just can't do that, unless you get him in the neck, but I don't think she has the foresight to do that.
Well, I feel like you would need Hansi to incapacitate Hansi with scissors.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You would need another Hansi. But she doesn't even get the chance to cut his hair, and you get the feeling that she was actually going to cut the hair. Because then the Lou and Hank start coming out of the woods.
Yeah, and they presumably were tipped off because the gas station attendant that Hansi leaves alive immediately sees his picture
in the newspaper. Which, to be truthful, I think that one made more sense to me because he just murdered several people.
Yes,
and they kind of know who they're looking for.
Sure,
so it makes sense that they would get his like picture.
But I like. Did you see? Soon. Was it? Did you see the name like the headline, the banner on the newspaper?
Yeah, it was like Indian or...
I wasn't sure. Was I wasn't sure off the top of my head, but I'm going like, I'm going to call it Exposition Press.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exposition Press.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then, yeah, Lou and Hank, having found the cabin, Hansi fires a shot at them. They fire back. Peggy takes that moment to actually stab Hansi with the scissors, yeah. Which accomplishes essentially nothing.
Yeah, well, it makes it... I think it makes it so I'm surprised he had to run away anyways, so to kind of maybe slow him down. I don't know. At that point, she just kind of went for it. I think she stopped thinking about it. She started being that stabber.
And his move was to try and kill them, but at that moment, his gun is either empty or jammed, and he can't – because he would have shot Ed right in the face.
Yeah,
that's realizing true. That's not a course of action, he bails as Hank and Lou come in the other door of the cabin. Blomquist's hands fly up. Episode ends.
Which is surprising, because I did not picture the Blomquist getting back into police hands at this point.
Right.
I thought it was going to happen at the end of the show. Or I thought they were going to end up dying, which they still could, but...
They still could. So, and on that note, because we are running short on time, I want to jump really quickly into predictions so that we can actually hit a little bit of that before we wrap.
To the spooky lights.
Spooky lights.
Predictions.
You're after Buzz TV.
Aliens. So the aliens are going to come down and brand everyone.
So, right, is that what we're building towards now? That the humans are now cattle for the aliens?
Yeah, maybe they think they're going to be saviors, and sure. They turn out to be just cattle for them.
Sure.
Man, that's one of my predictions.
I have completely abandoned trying to figure out how they're going to pay the alien thing off at all.
Oh, my God. I still don't know. Because they do it every other episode, too. They don't do it every episode. They have some nod to it. This was surprising that they had a little bit of a nod in this one. But I don't know if that's so much a nod or something. But I think it's going to be next episode. It's going to be alien heavy. That's my guess.
Sure. Okay.
And then the last episode is going to have something, too.
Well, and you know, now it's interesting where all the chips are laid. We know that the Blomquist are in police custody. Mm-hmm. We know that Mike Milligan is going to show up expecting to make this trade with Ed that Ed can no longer make because Dodd is not alive anymore.
Right.
We know that now Hansi's on the lam out by himself. And we know that this is all building towards some horrible incident at Sioux Falls that leads Lou to abandon his badge.
Yeah. Well, we also know that Lou... has Ed in custody, and I think Ed and Peggy are planning on just, I don't know, cooperating, unless Peggy has another break or decides something. But I could see Ed telling Lou about the meeting at Sioux Falls. So they try to work together to kind of do some stop Mike at Sioux Falls. That's my guess, but it's hard to say because they keep having interactions with Mike. And they don't arrest them. They don't do anything. They just try to have a conversation to stop the war from happening. But the war is happening, so maybe they try to actually take a more active part in the war and shut it down by meeting them there at Sioux Falls. And then that creates the giant massacre, but I'm not sure.
And that's the thing. And that's, I think, a credit to how brilliantly the show was written, is that every time I say, I think this is going to happen, it's not even similar to what happens.
It also, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Gerhardts now know about Sioux Falls as well, because I think the last time we see them is that guy admitting, like, this, the guy's been calling, or they think they found, wait, isn't there a phone call from Hanzi? Am I wrong here? That there's a last time we see them is they're on the compound, there's a phone call, and they say they found Dodd, and you see Floyd run into the house to get back on the phone.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then they might be heading towards Sioux Falls too.
So you've got presumably, and I can't imagine that Mike Milligan is going to go and make this exchange without telling anybody from Kansas City that that's what's happening. Right. I imagine to cover himself, there is a chance that he would get in touch with Kansas City, say the Gerhardts killed the Undertaker, I've got Dodd, I'm bringing him to you, and then he goes and gets Dodd, because then that mark, the fact his duplicity could mark him as well.
Right.
We don't know, because I would assume, because Kansas City, this big faceless entity led by Adam Arkin, apparently,
bald Adam Arkin,
is still the biggest malevolent force on the show. We've got characters like the remaining members of the Gerhardt clan, like Mike Milligan, who are certainly not pure of intent, but do not represent to me this big unstoppable force of malevolence that I think needs to descend upon some of our protagonists for something as dire as what older Lou describes to take place.
Yeah. There needs to be a massacre.
Yeah.
There needs to be something that's also, I think, in part Lou's fault that happens. And it could also mean the end of Hank.
That was my first assumption. And now I'm wondering, because that was my first assumption, is there any chance it's going to happen? I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah.
But I feel like, especially now being hobbled a little bit by his head injury, but still wanting to fight the good fight, I feel like that's the closest of all of the players on the board involved in. And I'm talking specifically about characters that could potentially be shot and killed.
Right.
I think Hank would represent certainly the biggest, most powerful loss for Lou on a personal level.
But Hank is also tied in with the alien mystery now.
So
he has to, I think he's the one to kind of bring that whole thing to an end. And maybe he does it in his untimely death. Maybe not. I don't know. So, but it might all be tied together.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
I think we'll get hints and some answers, I'm assuming, because with only two episodes left to go, we have to start tying up loose ends here.
Right.
I'm pretty sure next week we're going to see some characters meet their end in the story, whether it's violent or otherwise. Maybe we'll see aliens. Maybe we won't. Still holding out hope for Space Reagan.
Yeah.
I will die on that hill.
We're going to get Space Reagan somehow. That'll be also in my slash fiction.
I would hope so.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I'll buy two copies.
Chapter one, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And there is a sense of encroaching inevitability and darkness to all of it, and that just makes me really excited.
Yeah, it's great.
And I think, unless you got anything else, I think that's going to do it for us this week.
I think that's it.
Okay, so Mr. Dave Child, where can people find you on the internet?
At Mr. Dave Child or DaveChild.com.
Okay, yeah. I will also be out there on the internet-y, webby things, trying to figure out whether or not the aliens are coming.
Yep.
I'm all over at the Lex Michael. Thank you guys for tuning in. We will see you next week to talk about Fargo a little bit more.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.